Thank you, Michael, and also to Ian Dozier for putting this on the program. And it's really a privilege to be here. I'm delighted to be here. I really think this is a profoundly important story to tell. And I think because of what you do and because of what you're passionate about, that you're going to be in the leadership of doing something about it. And Matt did a wonderful job of pointing out the complexity of it. And really, without overtly saying it, that we're going to have a revolution in order to fix some of these things. I have no relationships to disclose, but I have a really good marriage. I thought that up. So you've heard about David Barker and the Barker hypothesis. And just to give you an early version of it when we thought it was simpler, he basically proposed that adverse intrauterine conditions induce perhaps adaptive, perhaps not, but many adaptive fetal responses, which can permanently alter, and we use the term program, which can program postnatal organ structure, function, and homeostatic set points in various regulatory systems, so that a baby that's born after such an adverse intrauterine exposure is really different, has a different phenotype, and very importantly, will respond to the postnatal environment differently. And that we know now that over and over again in different settings that that's the case. Many of these changes that occur, these adaptations, improve fetal survival, but they may make it difficult in terms of surviving in the postnatal environment. And I'll show you some examples of that. Now, you saw from Michael, you saw the Time magazine, if you haven't seen it, from October 4th this year, I hope you'll look. This is an older one, so this has been making the press for a while, and I just keep a running list. And I think Matt outlined for you how many different outcomes we're learning are affected by the intrauterine environment. Now, I'm a kidney doc, and I've dealt with kidney disease and hypertension, so I'm coming at this from a very different perspective. But I think I can use the kidney and the problem of kidney disease and hypertension as examples, and to give you some very concrete idea of how this might work, how you can link intrauterine exposures, particularly poor nutrition, and these adverse outcomes. Now, when this started out, it was the Barker hypothesis, and then it was formalized by a society, and they called it the Fetal Origins of Adult Disease, or FOAD. Well, let me tell you, that was embarrassing. You know, that was a terrible name. So we were so excited that they were going to rename it. And they renamed it Developmental Origins of Health and Disease, which turns out to be DOHAD, duh. So you either cry or you get silly. And so I think that the Pillsbury Doughboy, DOHAD, is a perfect icon, and I give you that so you can remember DOHAD, particularly remember the meeting in Portland in 2011. This is a brain exercise. So as a nephrologist with no since medical school, any exposure to thinking about what happens in utero, much less before that, this was the brain exercise that I had to go through. And let me see, I'm going to do my pointer here. Okay. All right, so I'm showing three generations of women, and I'm calling this the daughter. And if I think about what affects her risk of disease, I have to think about nutritionally, I have to think about the entire nutritional history. And that includes her childhood. And as you've just heard, it includes nutritional exposures in the womb, certainly therefore the mother's nutrition. And we have studies now that tell us that it's not just the mother's nutrition here, it goes all the way back through the mother's childhood and her exposures in the womb. So we're talking about all the way back to grandma's womb to set the nutritional state and the risk of chronic disease in this individual. And I'll remind you that the egg that gave rise to this individual was created back here in grandmother's womb when mother's ovary developed. So it's experiencing the nutritional history as you move forward. So it's an amazing concept. I want to make some key points, and again, I'll use hypertension and kidney disease as sort of the example. You've already heard some history. I'll elaborate on that a bit. I'm going to talk mostly about fetal undernutrition, and Matt has given you a great view of the other end of overnutrition and obesity. What we find is that fetal undernutrition increases vulnerability to disease, not specifically that you're going to get it, but that your risk is increased. At the same time, and you heard about this in terms of changing appetite, fetal undernutrition creates the potential for rapid postnatal growth. And what we've learned, and I'll show you some of this data, is that accelerated postnatal growth, and you heard some from Matt as well, enhances disease risk. And again, that brings up a potential for intervention. And that increased risk is most dramatic in babies who've been born small. And I'll just have a couple of words to say, and you've already heard the story about overnutrition, that also increases vulnerability. And one of the differences between undernutrition and overnutrition is that with maternal high-fat diet and obesity, the disease starts appearing in childhood as opposed to typically in young adulthood in this setting. And I think this group will understand the implications for public health. I think I may be going backwards. Okay, so history. You heard about David Barker's study from Michael Kogan in his introduction, and I just want to remind you this was was done in a little English village. He had to go searching for birth cohorts that could help him understand why infant mortality was occurring in the same, high infant mortality was occurring in the same counties in England as high coronary disease. Everybody thought that coronary disease was due to a rich diet and it should be associated with affluence. So he went to the small English villages, and in this particular one, he was able to find a treasure trove of information that was kept by a very dedicated public health nurse about baby's birth, weight, height, mom's diet, and because nobody leaves little English villages, they were still there 50 years later for David Barker and his colleagues to come in and find out what happened. So using that information, they used birth weight as the surrogate measure of fetal growth in the womb. Very crude measure, and because they could get to the individuals and find out the outcomes, they were able to make this amazing observation that almost every chronic disease outcome they looked at was inversely proportional to birth weight. So this is standardized overall mortality, and you can see the lower the birth weight, the higher the mortality. Coronary disease, this is not from that study, it's a later study in American Nurses showing the same thing with coronary disease and stroke. The lower the birth weight, the higher the risk of disease. And it wasn't just at this very end of very low birth weight, it was across the birth weight spectrum. Same was true for glucose intolerance or diabetes. I stuck this in to remind myself to tell you this was done before there was much of an incidence of either obesity or gestational diabetes. If we did this, and we see this in more modern populations, that there is an upswing at the higher birth weights because of gestational diabetes. And this is hypertension. This proved to be one of the very controversial ones, but finally that was settled and clearly has the same pattern. So the lower the birth weight, in this case, the higher the systolic blood pressure. And you can also show it's the higher incidence of hypertension. Now, why birth weight? It's very crude, and certainly it's not just the fact of low birth weight. It's what low birth weight was telling you. And in fact, these are babies that, and David Barker has a slide with lots more than this too, but you can see the difference. This is a normally grown baby, and this is a baby that suffered intrauterine growth restriction. And there's a very typical response in a fetus when there is inadequate nutrition. Blood flow distribution changes. They have relative failure to grow in weight rather than length, so they tend to be thin, whether or not they're short. The blood flow distribution favors the head and the heart, so their heads tend to stay larger, so-called brain sparing. Because the intra-abdominal muscles are hit hard in terms of low volume, they have a small abdominal girth, largely reflecting a lower liver size. Their muscle mass is typically lower, so you can see, compare the arms and legs, lower arm circumference. And in some babies, especially in Asia, they tend to preserve central fat. It's not always true in the U.S. So back to DOHAD, it turns out it's really not such a bad icon for developmental origins of disease. That head's pretty big, there's been brain sparing, and there's abdominal obesity, central fat, which of course is the dangerous kind. So remember DOHAD. So what I want to do is try to make some links between poor fetal nutrition, how that vulnerability at birth is created, and how that then interacts with postnatal factors to cause what we recognize as cardiometabolic syndrome. I'm sure many of you are familiar with that. Multiple abnormalities that tend to cluster together. Hypertension, abdominal obesity, diabetes, altered lipids, coronary heart disease. And I'm including kidney disease because we now include that in the mix. And I'm going to focus again on hypertension and renal disease. So this is another way of looking at the increased risk of high blood pressure when you're born small. This is the American Nurses study that in which the same individuals were studied at two different time points, 15 years apart. And it makes the point that with hypertension, that we call developmental hypertension, the relationship is present in the younger age group, but it is more dramatic with age. So this is typical of hypertension. It gets worse with age if you were born small. End-stage renal disease. This would look much steeper if I showed chronic kidney disease, but actually getting to end-stage renal disease requiring dialysis also has an inverse relationship. And as I'll show you, it's not just because of hypertension that's hurting the kidney. There are other factors. So I want to tell you something about how the intrauterine environment with fetal undernutrition alters organ structure, using the kidney as an example. And I want to tell you something about altered homeostatic set points, particularly energy utilization and what we call the thrifty phenotype. And if there's time, a little bit about blood pressure regulation and the fact that babies born small are, throughout the rest of their life, hyperreactive to stress. And then some interactions. So in thinking about altered organ structure in utero, it matters when the exposure occurs and how it relates to that particular organ and what its developmental trajectory is. So for the kidney, here, you can see that it starts fairly early, and it's all done by about 36 weeks of gestation. The functional units of the kidney are called nephrons, and there's one filter, glomerulus, at the top of each nephron, and then you have the tubule that is important for the urine formation. All of the functional units you're going to get are there by 36 weeks. No nephrons form after birth. And this just shows it in terms of where we've counted the number of glomeruli. This is just schematic. It's the last half of gestation where the most rapid increase in nephron number are going to occur. And that is where there's most risk if there's poor uterine nutrition during that period. And what happens is that there are fewer number of functional nephrons formed during that developmental period. And just to show you in a general way what that's like, the developing kidney forms in layers. And so what I'm showing you is that you have this branching process, this serial branching, and that in the outer layer is where the new nephrons are forming by tissue condensing around the tips of these branches. So down here you have older nephrons, they're more mature, until finally you get your eventual full component of nephrons. When you slow that process down by reduced nutrition, what you do is you still get normal nephrons, but you do not get as many layers. So a reduced number of nephrons is a very important aspect of undernutrition in utero. We know, we actually have very little data in humans. We're beginning to get some finally, and that's because it's so difficult. You have to have a whole kidney to count the number of nephrons. So until we get the imaging methods to do this non-invasively, which I'm dying to have, we won't know. It's my jump. Sorry, fall over here. So what this shows is that we do know in humans that poor intrauterine growth, and these were frankly growth-restricted babies that are shown in the orange X's. The total number of nephrons in most of those individuals in this very small study, obviously done after death and harvesting the kidneys, were reduced. So we know this applies to humans. This was some of the earliest data. And more recently, in several groups around the world who are collaborating to collect kidneys and try to understand this better, we know that the number of nephrons that you come into the world with is very tightly correlated with your birth weight. And as a clinician, I would love to know what every one of my patients' nephron number is, because that's actually more important than measuring their filtration rate, which is what we usually measure. The filtration rate can't tell you that, particularly in early stages of nephron loss. Now I can ask what the birth weight was. And I want to emphasize that everything I'm telling you is related to full-term births. The prematurity issue is totally separate, very important story, but that's not what I'm talking about here. In nephrology world, we have known for a very long time that there needs to be a match-up between the number of nephrons you have and your body size. Very important. We learned this from transplant. So early, you know, people started transplanting before we knew anything. It's much better now. But early on, they put kidneys, a kidney from a small person into a large person. And it turned out those kidneys did not last very long. And that's because they didn't have the number of nephrons needed to support that bigger body and that higher excretory load. And so we know if that mismatch occurs and it's severe enough that there is a substantial risk of developing high blood pressure and kidney disease. That's in the transplant setting. Now, I'm going to move to something else and come back to this in just a minute. So I want to go to the concept of altered homeostatic set points as a mechanism of nutritional programming and talk to you about energy utilization and the fact that that is actually changed in utero by circumstances of poor nutrition. And we learned that through the work of David Barker. It's what I think of as the second phase. If the English villages are the first phase, the second phase are the studies that he did with the Finns, with the Helsinki cohort. And these were phenomenal populations because there was so much data, and they actually had growth data recorded over virtually every year for every child up to 15 years of age, so really a gold mine. And they were able to access in various ways the adult outcomes. What they found was that accelerated childhood growth enhances disease risk for anybody, but it really enhances it for babies who are born small. And so in these Helsinki cohorts, they had growth data, not only birth weight and a lot of maternal information, but later in life growth, and they were able to look at the various outcomes and consider the pattern of growth that was associated with this. And again, I'm going to use hypertension as the example. So here are roughly 9,000 individuals that they're studying, among whom there were about 1,400 who, as adults, they had information to say they were hypertensive. And so they ask, how did these individuals grow after birth in compared to those who did not develop hypertension? And so, as you can see here, you won't be surprised to learn that they were small at birth. They were also thin. Their growth was not particularly different this parallel, meaning it's the same rate, until about 5 years of age. And then you can see it takes off, and there's accelerated growth. They're crossing centiles after that period. And they could come back at the population in a different way and show that that accelerated growth was increasing the risk of disease, particularly in these individuals who were born small. And particularly the disease here was hypertension, but you can show it in other of these chronic disease outcomes as well. So that then gets us back to the concept that David Barker and his colleague Nick Hales observed, and that Matt talked a little bit about when he told you there are changes in appetite circuits in utero when there is poor nutrition. And so in fact, and you saw something similar to this from Matt looking at blood pressure in three-year-olds. This is from the Helsinki cohort looking at individuals who were 62 years of age and relating, looking at that interaction between how big they were at birth and how big they were in their postnatal, or actually in their adult life in this study. And just if you look at the extremes, if you were large and you stayed in the lower quintiles of body weight as a 62-year-old adult on average, your risk of hypertension was 4%. If you were born small, your risk was clearly increased, even if you stayed small. But if you gained weight, if you cross centiles, 63% if you were in that upper age. So there's a tremendous interaction there and risk of being born small for this particular outcome, hypertension. And again, you could show exactly the same thing if you used metabolic syndrome, that constellation of abnormalities, which includes obesity, insulin resistance, diabetes, abdominal obesity, et cetera. And I want to just remind you, these were data taken from people who were born in the 30s and 40s, or actually growing up in the 30s and 40s. And these individuals who were rapidly gaining weight were not obese. You could not look at them and tell that these were going to be people at risk for developing these other diseases. The only way you would know is if you tracked their growth on the pediatrician's centile charts and see it. And so I think David Barker would love to see everyone tracking children's growth as another way of looking at their potential for risk. So the thrifty phenotype then, in fact what's happening is that poor intrauterine nutrition is causing permanent changes in the way that baby will interact with energy available in the postnatal environment. The utilization of energy is more efficient. You heard about changes in appetite circuits, and so there's actually an increase in appetite. That was a stunner for me as a clinician, dealing with people who have high blood pressure, and many of those individuals are obese because those go together, and understanding that there's this biological change that can occur. It changes who you are and changes your appetite. And certainly that was promoting survival in utero. On the other hand, it was leading, if you were born into the same sort of sparse nutrient environment that you experienced in utero, you'd be fine. And we know that from rural India, where the environment is very low in calories, the animals are skinny, everybody's skinny, and they don't have disease unless they move to the urban environment. And then they encounter high calories, high fat, and those urban centers are now in India experiencing tremendous epidemics of metabolic syndrome type features. So I want to show you how this is going to interact with reduced number of nephrons. So here we have somebody who's been programmed in utero to have this thrifty phenotype, and they're born into a situation where there's plenty of food. It's biologically predetermined, if you don't intervene, that they're going to have accelerated growth. It does not have to include obesity. They're going to move to a body mass that's higher than the body mass they were born with. They're going to cross centiles. And now, if we put that together with the fact that they've also had reduced number of nephrons, And so if they had stayed at that low body weight status through the postnatal and adult period, they'd be fine. But because of this factor in this nutrient-rich environment, we're going to see a mismatch, potentially modest, but also potentially very large. And in our environment today, with such a propensity for obesity, the likelihood is that this will include obesity and, again, magnify that mismatch that is so bad in terms of risk for blood pressure, high blood pressure, and kidney disease. Now, I want you to, if you can't stand this, just close your eyes. Okay, the medical students, it drives them nuts. But I'm going to tell you anyway, because I think it can be empowering when you can tell a mom who, let's say, is overweight, wants to get pregnant, and if you can give them reasons why it's important to eat in a certain way, because they can impact the health of their child. And so in this particular story, we know for many decades what those nephrons do when they're forced to overwork because the body mass is too high. And you can either reduce the number of nephrons or you can increase the body mass experimentally, either way, also clinically. And we know that the nephrons are going to pick up the slack. If they, the ones that are lost, that somehow transmitted, and the remaining nephrons will increase the pressure within the glomerular capillary filter, and they will, that will allow them to increase the single nephron glomerular filtration rate. So they are going to work hard, harder than they were, and it's going to be done by increasing pressure. And if that pressure, if there's too much of a load and it lasts for too long, there's going to be damage to the nephron because of that response, which is helpful acutely. It helps you maintain your excretory capacity, but it damages on the long term. And I just want to show you this for fun, to think about the fact that you can't tell this, you can't figure this out by all the clinical tests we do. So here, let's say this is normal. Here are all your nephrons represented by glomeruli, and each one is working at a filtration rate of 10 cc's per minute, and the total is 90. Everything is normal. Let's say that you come into the world and you've lost, or you have a third fewer because you've been undernourished in utero in the last half of pregnancy. I can't tell this. You can't tell this. Nobody can tell this unless you take the kidney out to see that they're all working harder. And as long as they don't have to work too hard, they can make up the difference. So you cannot tell that they're overworked. But if things come along to stress the kidney, if they develop hypertension, if they develop obesity that further overloads this, then what you see is you begin to get down to a level of nephrons where you can see it clinically. They can't keep up with the normal GFR. So this is the way we think about kidney disease and the fact that we can't tell clinically in these early stages. We need to know in advance that somebody has reduced nephron number. And right now, what we do is look at their birth weight. And this is just to emphasize that mismatch between body mass and nephrons actually over time with that high pressure will damage the glomerulus, the filtering unit. That can, you'll lose this one. The others then have to work harder. So again, it's that cycle. As you lose those nephrons, you have impaired salt excretion and ultimately chronic kidney disease, and if it persists, end-stage disease. So very important links between fewer nephrons at birth, the thrifty phenotype, and the risk for hypertension and kidney disease. And I think I will not tell you much about this latter one except to say that it's important that hyperreactivity to the environmental stresses is characteristic of babies who have been born small. And I'm not going to tell you the details of that, but we do know that. And I will say that, in a sense, what you're doing is you're setting up an individual who's suffered for intrauterine undernutrition to really see the Western culture as toxic. So everything that we do in our environment is toxic to this individual, whether it's the calories and the stimuli to accelerated growth, with or without overt obesity, bodybuilding, seen small people who, especially men, who overcome their size with bodybuilding. That loads the kidney. If they're already small, that's bad. High salt diet, high protein diets, those are all things that require the kidney to accommodate, and you can overcome it. You can create a toxic situation if you have inadequate nephrons for your body size, etc. You've already heard about the double burden of malnutrition, and in fact, we think of overnutrition as another form of malnutrition, and as you've heard from Matt, causing the same sorts of metabolic syndrome and cardiovascular disease. Very interesting, two different sides of the spectrum with similar common pathways. And again, emphasizing what Matt said, is this transgenerational transmission of disease where obesity, because it occurs in childhood, is moving straight down the path. So I'm going to end there. A girl is a mother from the time of her own conception. A mother is the biological bridge to the health of future generations, and we need all of you to do something about this. Thank you.
I'm a general internist student in Toledo, Ohio, and I don't have birth weight charts for my patients. Amazingly, the clinic I worked in for 30 years, that data is there because we don't have an, unfortunately, paper chart that actually would include the pediatric record when they roll over. So I thought this is fascinating. I mean, I'm going to take your card for you. I'd like you to come to my nursing school and run on this because you've got a good bit of pathology research going on there. But this was very eye-opening, a complete accident. Actually connected to the last session which we were in, where we were looking at outcomes in, and disparities in the American population. And looking back a couple of generations now, it actually makes a lot of sense in terms of thinking about the people I'm seeing now, what was going on with their mothers and the mothers' mothers. And it really makes me wonder whether we're looking deeply enough at some of those issues in our disparities research as well. Mm-hmm. So thank you. I guess that's not a question, it's a comment. But one of the other things that came up, you mentioned something about a transplantation, the number of nephrons. Do transplantation surgeons actually biopsy the kidney?
They do biopsy the kidney, but they do not have the capacity to tell the number of nephrons. They just learn by experience that a small person, who presumably would have a long birth weight, that that kidney would not work well for a large individual.
So they learn by experience. Biopsy would give you no markers to really help you know.
At this point, no, you wouldn't be able to tell the number of nephrons. You could tell the health of the nephrons in the body. But your clinic that you describe, when you have the pediatric record over, that could be wonderful.
Yeah, I'm wondering if I'm going to go back and find out. Because the chart, some of them are like this. I've been there 30 years. I'm taking care of the children and some of the people who are.
So, it's great. Right. Okay. Okay. Let's kind of move on to another question. Yes, sir? So the question is about an environmental link with all of this.
Yeah, thanks, Tony. It's nice to see you. So I think it's a really good question, and I think there are a couple answers to this. One is I think we can learn a lot about etiology by looking at behavior and biology. It doesn't always tell us how to act. And I was making the point that behavior is often constrained by our environment, and even when we try to encourage people to change behavior, it's very hard. And the major example right now is people live in an obesogenic environment, and it's very hard to change people's diet, activity, media viewing, sleep habits, etc. in this environment. And so many people are now looking more at the macro level about ways to change the environment so that behavior can be changed per force. We have to think about that throughout the life course. You know, so what makes sense during pregnancy, what makes sense during infancy, preschool, childhood, adolescent, etc. Because the environmental forces at each of those parts of the life course really differ. And we can talk more about, you know, what some examples might be, but I think it's a really good point. Does that address your question?
Yeah, it does. And I think one question is whether the biology will help us pinpoint environment.
Yes, I think there's a great potential for the biology to lead us to the right environmental interventions. Because if we can figure out, for example, how a social structure or a social network leads to particular biology, it might be through behavior, it might not be through behavior, it might be directly to physiology. It could tell us something about how to intervene.
Okay, the man way in the back, or person way in the back?
What a great question. The question is when the NHLBI Pediatric Risk Reduction Guidelines will be released. I was actually a member of that panel, and we concluded our deliberations about 2 years ago, and it's going through a number of levels and channels which within the government. So we hope within a few months.
Yeah, so what else should we add to our agenda beyond the policy work? So I'll let both of you.
Is that Maxine? Hi, how are you? So I think we don't quite know yet, but I think when we think about infancy and early childhood, we have some hypotheses about policies that might be important. So for example, a place that kids spend a lot of time from infancy through age 5 is childcare. And we're only in the beginning stages of learning how the childcare environment affects behavior and physiology. But we already know that childcare regulations vary quite a bit throughout the United States, both for childcare centers and for family childcare homes. And I think that's an example of one place where we can really benefit by thinking about policies that can affect behaviors, that can affect physiology, that can affect disease. Is that, yeah.
And I would add to that,
so in Portland, Oregon, there are really a lot of things going on that I think would address your question. So for example, there's a farm to Head Start program. There are farm to school programs. The schools are getting the kids involved in gardens, school gardens that are supplying the cafeteria, but they're also engaging the kids with knowing what fresh foods are. There's this tremendous ignorance throughout our country of knowing which vegetables are which, how to prepare them, why it matters, what a balanced diet is, all of those things. So I think that's part of it, is the food culture at that level of knowing what it is. There's the whole sphere of what is marketed and what is marketed to kids specifically. There's what I read in the New York Times on Sunday about an arm of the USDA is in charge of keeping up sales for the dairy farmers. And so they're partnering with Pizza Hut and all manner of different pizza organizations, private enterprises, to double the cheese in the pizza. And they brag about how much more cheese has been sold because of these efforts. On the other side of the coin, the USDA is trying to put out guidelines which say that decreasing saturated fat is really important. So those kinds of obvious problems to me, we should be looking at, among other things.
So the question is, how does sleep actually factor into some of this?
So there are now studies in children and adults showing that decreased sleep duration, the epidemiologic studies, that decreased sleep duration leads to increased weight gain and diabetes. There are experimental studies, mostly in adults, not much in children, showing that if you bring somebody into a lab and decrease their sleep, it can actually alter appetite-regulating hormones that would lead to increased energy intake. So there's a building evidence base that decreased sleep duration and maybe decreased sleep efficiency, the quality of sleep, can lead to obesity and its consequences. So that leads to questions, you know, if we think this is a causal link, how do we change it? And I actually think that infant sleep is a great hook for parents, because mothers and fathers want their kids to sleep so they can sleep, right? And so I think it actually represents a sweet spot for intervention. And what we're learning is, you know, from some of the pilot work we're doing, that the environment, the micro and macro environment for sleep in our country is not very good. A lot of families now don't have routines about sleep. One of our hypotheses is that one of the reasons that media exposure is related to obesity is because TVs keep kids from going to sleep. We also know that there are macroenvironmental factors like air pollution that are probably related to decreased sleep duration and efficiency. So I think there are a lot of things that could lead to macro, micro, and behavioral interventions to improve sleep quality and quantity. Yeah, certainly sleep all the way through makes a difference. We have some preliminary data suggesting that maybe sleep in infancy is more important than sleep later in childhood. You know, we're always, as we were talking about before, thinking about these critical periods, and maybe there are neural connections that are happening in early infancy and in toddlerhood that have an effect later. So jury's still out on that.
You can start.
Sure.
Okay. Go ahead. Do you want to paraphrase that?
So I guess the question is about people's knowledge and attitudes, fairly entrenched in relation to new knowledge coming out that might controvert their knowledge and attitudes. So again, a lot of my work is in obesity, so that's how I think about it, but. We do have, I think, some big issues throughout the population right now, because as the population gets more overweight and obese, the new normal is to be overweight and obese. And so both anecdotally and studies suggest that people don't recognize when overweight is present. So it's not only the risk factors that are an issue, it's the actual prevalence of this condition that's an issue. So, I mean, there are a lot of answers to the question, but, you know, one answer could be that if it's really hard to change people's attitudes, if it's hard to change people's knowledge and attitudes to lead to behavior change, maybe we're more in the realm of changing the environment, so behavior changes no matter what. And that's an interesting thing to think about.
Thank you all for...